Thank you for listening to this Podcast One Sportsnet production, available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
The following program is a PodcastOne.com production.
He started in a small town in Texas. Worked his ass off to become one of the most famous wrestlers of all time.
We're going to take care of business tonight, and that's the bottom line.
And now, he's dominating the world of on-demand audio.
And he's doing it for the working man.
This is a damn good outlet for me to spew the bullshit off my brain.
Yeah!
This is the Steve Austin Show. Unleashed.
All right, everybody, welcome to the Steve Austin Show. I am coming to you from the mean streets of Los Angeles, California today. I am sitting in my office at 316 Gimmick Street. I have the window cracked. There's a nice breeze coming through, and it feels damn good. The Pearl Beer neon clock sitting in front of me on this desk says it's 10:40 in the a.m., which means when I finish this open and this close, this podcast, I'm going to jump my ass in my white and silver Ford Bronco and haul ass to the gym. Today is upper body day. Yesterday was legs. It's back to supersetting, pre-exhaustion, and more supersetting, upper torso type stuff. Then I'll jump on the elliptical and get in 45 to 60 minutes of cardio there. Finally kicking back into cardio. I stay off the treadmill a little bit because if I were to actually trip and fall down, believe it or not, I've done that before. I ain't going to fall on my shoulder. So I can kick up the intensity a little bit by staying on the elliptical and get the heart rate going. And anyway, so that's my plan of attack once I finish this podcast. I'm looking forward to getting over to PHX, Phoenix, Arizona, and interviewing AJ Styles, a phenomenal one, coming up next Monday on WWE Network on the Stone Cold podcast. Been reading a lot about AJ, been watching a lot of his matches from over in Japan and a lot of his stuff in TNA. People are wondering, hey, man, it's the WWE podcast. Are they going to talk about TNA at all on this podcast? Well, of course we are, because that's where a big part of AJ Styles spent his career. So, of course, we're going to talk about TNA. The fact that it's three different letters other than WWE doesn't mean a damn thing. If it's material that needs to be covered, then we're going to cover that material. We're going to cover AJ's career. We're going to get into his background and talk to him a little bit about his personal life. So, anyway, I've been very impressed with him. It's going to be an interesting conversation because this podcast is going to happen one day after AJ Styles wrestles John Cena at a pay-per-view. It'll be interesting to see how that match goes. I expect John Cena, with his enthusiasm, with his excitement level of being back full-time, coming back from that rotator cuff injury, is going to be on fire and ready to go. The stuff they've been doing on the show the last few weeks has been really good. I'm looking forward to seeing AJ, as he had a couple of phenomenal, no pun intended, matches with Roman Reigns. I look forward to seeing what him and John Cena can bring up and see how involved that crowd gets, because when John Cena comes out, there is a crowd divided, and they all respect him, and they all cheer for him, or they boo him, but it is pandemonium. And so with these two guys in there, as over as John Cena is, AJ Styles continues to gain momentum, but he's one of the best workers in the world right now. To see what happens when the bell rings, it's going to be real interesting. I'm looking forward to seeing that pay-per-view. Hopefully, I'll be breaking down that pay-per-view with Wade Keller afterwards. And speaking of wrestling, I've been checking my email as of late, and I get these Google alerts for Steve Austin or Stone Cold Steve Austin. And a lot of the articles that have been coming up on my email that are being written from all the various mainstream magazines to wrestling publications to dirt sheets, whatever you want to call them, there's been some headlines that Steve Austin said AJ Styles carried Roman Reigns in two matches, and there'll be quotation marks around carried, like it was an insult. No, it wasn't no damn insult when I said he carried Roman Reigns to those matches, because he did. I said Roman Reigns did his share in the match, and he did. And if you go back to those two podcasts, you will hear how much I praised Roman Reigns. So then when they say carried and put the quotation marks, it's like I'm throwing Roman under the bus. Couldn't be further from the truth. But if you know anything about the business of pro wrestling, if you know anything about two guys getting in the ring, if you watch Ric Flair carry Sting, you know who was the man in that match. Sting did his part, you damn right. Flair got him over. Flair carried Lex Luger. I don't know how many matches. You know, I could name all kinds of names of people that carried opponents. That's what a veteran does. When you've been working 16 or 18 years like AJ has, you're expected to carry the five-year guy. That's just the way it happens. So all of a sudden, it's like I'm throwing this kid under the bus. No. Got a ton of respect for Roman. He had some actual fire in his last promo the other night in his altercation. I believe it was with Seth Rollins. The kid's finally starting to bring up his intensity in the form of anger and a little bit of focus. Now you're starting to grab me, Roman. Amp up. Amplify. Give me some energy. But going back, let me nitpick the promos there, but let me get back to covering the Google alerts about Stone Cold says AJ carried Roman Reigns like it was an insult. No, it wasn't an insult. You ask any veteran, anybody in that damn office, anybody who's booking, anybody, one of those producers that spent 10 or 20 years in the ring, who carried that match? Every single one of the answers is going to be AJ Styles. And if anybody says any different, they either don't know shit about the wrestling business or they're lying to you. So anyway, I'll back off the rant there, but hey, all of a sudden, these people that want to report about wrestling and try to make a clickbait article out of something I said. Yeah, I damn sure said it, and I damn sure meant it. And if you're blind, you didn't see the same match I saw. All due respect to blind people, I'm just trying to make a point. It is what it is, and it was what it was. I'm looking forward to talking to AJ Styles. I'm looking forward to seeing this match with John Cena coming up. And then again, like I said, Stone Cold Podcast coming up on the WWE Network. I'm looking forward to talking to this kid. It's been a long time coming. Hey, man, let me stop all the bullshit and start talking about my guest today. As you guys know, I went down to San Diego, and I talked to Bill Goldberg for a couple of episodes. And while I was down there, I was going to go down there and talk to a Navy SEAL named Jocko Willink. Jocko served as a Navy SEAL for 20 years, and me and Jocko got in touch over Twitter, and he was going to come down here in Los Angeles and do the podcast here. But I called him. I said, hey, dude, I'm going to be in San Diego anyway, so why don't I just spend the night down there, and then I'll come see you over at your gym, the Victory MMA in San Diego. So that's what we did. Jocko has a podcast. It's called the Jocko Podcast. It's very intense. I believe you can get it on Stitcher. If you want any information about it, go to JockoPodcast.com. Jocko is a very intense individual. He talks about a lot of war situations. He talks about jiu-jitsu. He talks about a lot about MMA. He talks about all kinds of things. He's a very intense individual. He's very engaging. He's very cool. And let me give you a little bit of, about Jocko. This is coming right from the JockoPodcast.com to frame up this conversation. In the Battle of Ramadi, he orchestrated SEAL operations that helped the Ready 1st Brigade of the U.S. Army's 1st Armored Division bring stability to the violent, war-torn city. Task Unit Bruiser became the most highly decorated special operations unit of the Iraq War. Jocko returned from Iraq to serve as officer in charge of training for all West Coast SEAL teams. There, he spearheaded the development of leadership training and personally instructed and mentored the next generation of SEAL leaders who have continued to perform with great success on the battlefield. During his career, Jocko was awarded the Silver Star, the Bronze Star, and numerous other personal and unit awards. In 2010, Jocko retired from the Navy and launched Echelon Front, where he teaches the leadership principles he learned on the battlefield to help others lead and win. Clients include individuals, teams, companies, and organizations across a wide range of industries and fields. All right. Now, Jocko also wrote a New York Times best-selling book with his friend and one of the guys who served on his platoon, Leif Baben. They co-authored this book. It's called Extreme Ownership, How U.S. Navy SEALs Lead and Win. I read this book from cover to cover. I also bought the audio book. It was a damn good read, and reading it is one thing because you can dog-ear the pages, you can highlight things. I listen to it. So when you have two Navy SEALs talking about what they did in their voices rather than me reading in mine, it's super impactful. My favorite chapter of the book is chapter 12 and talking about discipline and how this book affected me. This book is all about building leadership skills and teamwork. For me, I'm not really a part of a team, but it inspired me just as far as, hey, get up off your ass, take yourself to the next level, stop being complacent, get off your ass, and hey, let's go get back in shape. Discipline, chapter 12, if you're listening, the 1140 mark, chapter 12, when he starts talking there, Jocko narrates this chapter. I highly recommend this book to anybody and everybody. I thoroughly enjoyed it, and again, I haven't read too many books in my day, but this is a badass book. My conversation with Jocko takes care of this little piece of business, and we can't go any further without talking about our sponsors. And this is the kind of business that's going to make your entertainment budget go a little further. SeatGeek. SeatGeek is a great new app. It's going to make it easier than ever for you to buy and sell sports tickets and concert tickets. I know how it is when you want to buy tickets online, and most of the sites make it real hard to find what you want. And then they try to sneak in huge fees to checkout. Well, not SeatGeek. The SeatGeek app lets you find whatever tickets you want right from your phone. You want to go see Tom Morello and the Prophets of Rage this summer but didn't get tickets when they first went on sale? Maybe you want to take in a baseball game this summer or even an NFL preseason game in August? Then download the SeatGeek app and get a great deal on the seats you want. SeatGeek has taken all the work and hassle out of shopping for tickets. They pull all the tickets available from other sites into one place so you save time and never miss a deal. Every ticket on SeatGeek is given a grade based on value so you can immediately find underpriced seats. And SeatGeek is always honest and upfront about the price, so you get the full ticket price from start to finish and ain't surprised with huge fees when you check out. And all you Steve Austin Show fans get a $20 rebate off your first SeatGeek purchase. All you have to do is download the SeatGeek app. Go to the setting tab and click add a promo code. Enter the promo code Steve, and then SeatGeek will send you $20 after you've made your first ticket purchase. So download the SeatGeek app now and enter the promo code Steve.
Steve Austin. Steve Austin. Unleashed.
All right, we're rolling sound. It's Steve Austin. I'm coming to you from San Diego, California, Victory MMA Training Center. Jocko Willink is my guest, 20-year Navy SEAL decorated, along with his partner and Navy SEAL, Leif Babin, wrote the book, Extreme Ownership, How U.S. Navy SEALs Lead and Win. This is a badass book. I read the book, and I listened to the audio book. I did double duty. Jocko, welcome to the show. It's harder than hell for me to read anything. This book is riveting, and I enjoyed the hell out of it. Hey, man, let's go back a little bit. What made you decide to be a Navy SEAL?
You know, to be honest with you, the only thing I ever remember wanting to do in my life was be some kind of a commando. That's the only thing ever since I was a little kid, ever since I can remember wanting to do anything, I wanted to have a machine gun in my hands and I wanted to go kill bad guys. And as soon as I got old enough to start figuring out which one of those commando units I wanted to go into, I'd heard about a bunch of them. I heard about the SEAL teams. I had a friend of mine that was in the Army and he kind of indicated to me that the SEAL teams was the hardest training, the toughest guys. And I know that that's not true anymore. There's a bunch of great guys in all the branches. But when I heard that about the SEAL teams, I said to myself, all right, that's where I'm going.
Were you like a team guy from the get-go? Or did you play organized sports when you were growing up?
I played soccer and basketball. I was marginal at both of them at best. You know, I was no star athlete or anything like that. I was just kind of Joe average in athletics. And I guess the only thing I had going for me in the fact that I wasn't extremely athletically gifted was I had to work hard. And so when you got to work hard and that becomes part of your genetics, then going through SEAL training, which, yeah, it pays. It's nice if you're a good athlete, but I had plenty of good athletes in my class that quit. You know, I tell a story all the time that I had a NCAA water polo player in my class quit, and I had a guy that was an Olympic alternate for the gymnastics team, and he quit. And there I was, like I said, Joe average, wasn't winning any races, but I was finishing them.
Where did you grow up at? Because I mean, I did all the research on you, but I don't know, where are you from?
I grew up in New England. I grew up in, you know, in Connecticut and Maine. Grew up on a dirt road in the middle of nowhere.
What's the background? Your father, what did he do?
My mom and dad were both school teachers. So as you can imagine, I didn't like school too much.
That was my question. What kind of grades you make? Because, I mean, when I'm reading this book and some of the life lessons, I mean, you're teaching people how to be leaders. You were, and what you did. So you're a rocket scientist, great student, but could you come off highly intelligent in the book?
Well, I can tell you right now, when I was a kid, I was borderline juvenile delinquent. I was a troublemaker. I had a lot of energy. There was no place to focus that energy besides finding mischief and causing troubles and getting into fights and stuff like that. And so the best thing that ever happened to me was I joined the military, because all of a sudden you get in the military and they look at you and say, okay, this is what you got to do to be successful. You got to follow these steps right here. And I said, oh, I can do that. And that's why for me, joining the military was the best thing that happened.
Now, when you're fighting on the schoolyards or wherever, you basically just slugging it out because you didn't have any fighting schools. Because in reading the book, I mean, one of your instructors or someone, officer above you, said, hey, a couple of guys, y'all want to learn how to fight? And you said yes. And that's how you basically got into MMA, correct?
That's how I got into jiu-jitsu for sure. And which this was pre-UFC, so it was 1992-93, and there was a old SEAL master chief, a great guy by the name of Steve Bailey, and he had trained martial arts his whole life, including he'd done a lot of Muay Thai. And then at one point, like many martial artists back in the day, he ran into one of the Gracie brothers, and they rolled him up and choked him out. And he said, oh shit, I gotta learn this stuff. And so then he started learning jiu-jitsu from those guys. And by the time 1992 or 1993 rolled around, I went on deployment. He was the senior guy there, the senior master chief there. And he just asked us one day, said, hey, who in this platoon wants to learn how to fight? And I, of course, raised my hand because I wanted to learn how to fight. And that was the beginning of jiu-jitsu career for me.
But it suited your mentality because, I mean, were you just of a combat mindset because you were already fighting in school, or just because, hey, if I'm Navy SEAL, the better I can fight, the better chance I have to survive?
Well, both those. And I'll tell you, I'm a man. And when you're a man in the world, other men are going to try and step up sometimes and either prove themselves against you or take something from you or push you around. And, you know, I grew up like any other kid in America. If you didn't know how to stand up for yourself, you were going to have to take the back seat. And so, you know, I was a scrappy kid, but it wasn't until I started learning jiu-jitsu that you realize that there's something a lot more powerful than just throwing bombs at someone. You can actually learn how to fight, and there's a real skill to it.
Well, it was funny because, well, not funny, you had a young man came here a while back and did an interview with you, and so you rolled a little bit in the ring with him, and so you basically took this guy to school. And it was, he sent me a tweet on my social media account, and you know, basically you had knowledge, you had strength, power, and technique. And so a guy with no skills, the technique and the know-how, because if you're going against a guy that's just equally as big and strong as you are, that's one thing. But if you have the techniques and the black belt and the black belt in jiu-jitsu, obviously that bodes better for you than not having any skill at all. But being a puncher,
It's a technique, it's a skill, just like any other sport that's out there. And if you've never played basketball before and you go against a kid that plays basketball all the time, you're going to get beat. If you go play soccer against someone that you never played soccer before and they played, they're going to beat you. If you play football against someone that plays football and you don't play football, you're going to get beat. If you get into a fight with a guy that fights every day and trains every day to be better at fighting, you're going to lose the fight. That's all there is to it.
Basic question. I don't want to say dumb question. How tough was SEAL school, Bud's?
You know, Bud's training for me was a good time, and I think a lot of people want to make it into something that it's not. If you're a tough person that's not going to give up, it's not that big of a deal. I had fun there. It was actually just a fun time for me, you know. Oh, do a bunch of push-ups, run, swim, run the obstacle course, be cold. And the whole time they're doing this to you, you're watching other people quit. So other people are quitting, and you're thinking, I mean, I was just thinking that person's just weak, just mentally weak, because how could you not be able to gut through this? It's not that big of a deal. So I didn't think SEAL training was that hard of an evolution. You know, the one thing that people always talk about is this week called Hell Week, where you basically don't sleep for 5 days. You don't sleep. You do a bunch of physical evolutions. And that's supposed to be the hardest thing in SEAL training. And for me, it was actually one of the easiest things in SEAL training, because the only requirement that you have to meet is that you don't quit. So some of the other things that were harder for me were a timed run, a timed swim, a timed obstacle course. Because like I already told you, I wasn't the fastest runner. I wasn't the fastest swimmer. So I had to put out hard. I had to sprint to pass the runs. But Hell Week was just grit and gut through it, which was probably one of my strengths, is just to suck it up and deal with it.
When you guys were sent over to Iraq, to Ramadi, and task unit Bruiser.
That's right.
How did the Bruiser name come to be? How do y'all go about that process?
Well, at a SEAL team, there's multiple task units, and they actually have names of the phonetic alphabet, which is like Alpha, Bravo, Charlie, Delta. And I had read a book a long time ago by a guy named Colonel David Hackworth, and he is a badass Army officer. He was in Korea, and he was in Vietnam. He was a battalion commander in Vietnam. And he told this story about he took over a battalion in Vietnam as the battalion commander. And one of the first things he did was rename the battalion. And he just said, look, the battalion was all jacked up. They were taking a lot of losses to the Vietnamese. They were totally disorganized. They were just weak. And he came in and changed the name of the battalion to the Hardcore. That's what he did out of the gate. He said, we're going to change the name of the battalion to the Hardcore. And the other thing that he did was, when they would meet each other, when they would greet each other, the officers, or the men would say to the officers, Hardcore Recondos. And then the officers would say back to the men, no fucking slack. And that's what they did. That's how they greeted themselves. And that's what they named themselves, the Hardcore. And so when I took over as the task unit commander, it was actually called Task Unit Bravo. And I said, we're not going to be called Task Unit Bravo. We're going to be called Task Unit Bruiser. And I think our name is going to speak for itself, because that's what we're going to do. We're going to crush everything that's in front of us. And we're going to dominate during the training that we go through. We're going to excel in everything that we partake in. And when we get overseas, we're going to crush the enemy.
That's a great mindset. When you went into SEAL school, how many guys did you go in with? How many graduated?
Well, the basic SEAL training that I went through, Buds, I think we started with around 120 or 130, and we graduated 35. There's usually about an 80%, 70 or 80% attrition rate, quitters.
Okay. So then out of the 35, what's the next level?
Well, once you're done with that, you just get assigned to a SEAL team.
Okay.
And I went to SEAL Team 1 right out here in San Diego, California. Formed up into a platoon and started getting after it.
Tell me about the training, because, man, basic underwater demolition. But then you're going to incorporate, you know, snipers, your EOD guys, the guys that are breaking shit down. Who determines, you know, what your specialty is going to be?
Right. So when you get done, the basic training, the BUDS, nobody cares about that once you get to the SEAL teams. It doesn't mean anything. You get to the SEAL teams,
that's just to make sure you got the medal to get through and you're qualified. Hey, man, this guy's tough.
Exactly. And even that is no guarantee.
Right.
Because you know what? There's people that go through SEAL training, and there's people that suck it up and they're tough. There's also people, like anywhere else in life, that learn the system and learn how to skate through it. That doesn't happen very often, but it happens. So that's why you get done with SEAL training, the basic SEAL training. You show up at a SEAL team. No one cares that you went through SEAL training. Now you start going through a couple different things that happen now. Well, you go through a little bit more advanced training with more shooting and more tactics. It's individual skills. And then once you finally get to a SEAL team is where you start working together with a SEAL platoon. And that's where the life is. The good life is in the SEAL platoon. That's where, you know, if I could have one job for the rest of my life, it'd just be a gunner in a SEAL platoon. It's a great job with a great bunch of guys with a very clearly defined mission, and that's just an awesome life. But when you're in that SEAL platoon, you're getting ready to deploy overseas, and so they got to put you through what's called a workup. And it's a training cycle that gets you ready to go overseas. And that's where you really learn to work together as a team. That's where you learn to shoot, move, and communicate. That's where you learn to close with and destroy the enemy. That's where you learn small unit tactics and maneuver warfare. That all happens in that platoon workup, which is actually what I ended up with at the end of my career. I ended up running that training for the last 3 years I was in the SEAL teams.
So when you're in the platoon school and you're immersed in all this training and you're soaking in all this knowledge, and it's do or die, I mean, this is what you chose to do. You damn should want to fail. Dude, do you have a life other than that? Are guys married? Are you guys living off base? Are you all in the barracks? Do you have any time to go have a couple of beers? I'm curious to know what's the other part of that life than the training part.
When you're a young SEAL,
gung-ho.
That's it. Gotcha. All I did, all I thought about was the SEAL teams. And when you're in a SEAL platoon, that's the only thing you think about. Now, you might be married. You might have kids. You might have family. You might have some other activities that you're engaged in. But they all take a second, third, and fourth seat to your premier goal in your life and your mission in life, which is to be a SEAL and to help that platoon be better. So there's guys, you know, I mean, unfortunately, the SEAL teams has a pretty high divorce rate because, you know, we got a lot of guys, myself included. My job was always more important. My job was the most important thing in my life. Even though I was married, had kids, my wife knew. My wife didn't even call me at work. She didn't expect to hear from me. When I left, she just ignored me. And good on her, because she was able to deal with that. She was able to take care of the kids as I was gone, you know, on multiple deployments overseas. But not everyone can pull that off. And so there's a high divorce rate because you get very focused on the job, and it's almost like nothing else matters.
All right, gang, we're going to take a quick minute to say thanks to all you folks for supporting the fine sponsors of the Steve Austin Show, including the ones that helped me before every single podcast on it. Onnit makes the Alpha Brain, and all you longtime listeners know that before I sit down and record my podcast, I take a couple of Alpha Brain and a couple of swigs of coffee, and then I hit the record button on my Zoom H4N. I do not podcast without Alpha Brain because I need to be razor sharp and laser focused. And if you could use a little mental boost yourself, go to onnit.com/Steve to get some Alpha Brain and save yourself 10% in the process. In fact, you can save 10% off anything you order at onnit.com/Steve. So, yes, you can get 10% off Shroom Tech Sport. Shroom Tech Sport will give your workouts a boost and helps you go longer and recover faster. And, yes, you can get 10% off T+. T+ increases strength and power, and it'll improve your athletic performance, and it's safe to use if you're competing. So go take advantage of this 10% discount off your order. Just go to onnit.com/Steve. And another great thing about Onnit and all their products is, if they don't work the way they're supposed to, you can get all your money back, no questions asked. Money back guarantee. So go to onnit.com/Steve to get your 10% discount off all supplements. That's onnit.com/Steve to get 10% off your order. What was your first trip over, your first tour, as you guys would call it?
Well, my first tour to Iraq was in 2003-2004. My first deployment as a SEAL was back in 92-93, but there was no war going on. But they still send you overseas. You'd work with foreign countries. You do big training exercises.
And you refer to those as, what do you call them, the dry years?
The dry years.
And with respect, was that boring to you because you wanted action? I mean, what's the mindset when it's the dry years and you're not in action?
It's a hard thing to deal with, but I will say this. Back then, we didn't know what combat was. It was this mystifying thing that was out there, and all we knew was we needed to be ready for it. That's what we knew. We needed to be ready for it. So all we did was train, prepare, train, and train, prepare. That's all we did. If we weren't working on our gear, we were shooting our guns. If we weren't shooting on our guns, we were diving. If we weren't diving, we were parachuting. If we weren't parachuting, we were shooting on our guns more. So that's what we did to try and be ready. And I'll tell you, we trained hard. And when you don't know anything about combat, you're just going to train for the worst case scenarios. Luckily, we had some guys from Vietnam that were still in the SEAL teams that taught us some of the basic principles that are on the book. Those came from old Vietnam SEALs, legendary Vietnam SEALs that said, hey, do this, don't do that. And I said, yes, sir. And so that's what it's like. I mean, it was definitely anticlimactic. Because all you want to do is go into combat. And like I said, this was for me. This was since I was a little kid.
Right.
So now I get to a SEAL team, and I missed the first Gulf War. I missed it. It was over. And so now I'm thinking, man, there might not be another war for my whole career. And so that's just – so all you can do is train, prepare, and keep your fingers crossed that something comes up.
So the first tour with the task unit, Bravo – well, not the first tour, but when you go to Ramadi, mm-hmm. I mean, that's the hottest zone over there in Iraq, right?
Yep.
So all of a sudden, you were in the dry years. You guys are training your ass off, doing all your stuff that you do to be highly skilled and ready. All of a sudden, you get to Ramadi. And that's a ball of shit. What were you thinking then? Hey, I'm in Wally World because this is what I want.
When I got to Ramadi, and this was actually, Ramadi was my second tour to Iraq. I had done a tour over there as a platoon commander, which basically meant I was an assault force commander of a bunch of SEALs. We'd go out in the middle of the night and capture, kill bad guys. That was our mission. And it was a good, solid deployment. We got to do real stuff. We got to mix it up with the enemy. But I'll tell you, it was actually pretty easy because we had prepared so well. The mission was pretty simple. We were going after a bunch of knuckleheads. And when 25 SEALs show up at the middle of your night, at your house at the middle of the night at 2 o'clock in the morning, they blow your door off its hinges and they're got guns sticking in your face, 30 seconds later, the enemy's not standing up to that. Especially at that time, the enemy wasn't organized. They weren't dedicated. They really didn't have their shit together yet. And it wasn't until later, in 2004, 2005, they really started to get organized. And by the time I deployed to Ramadi in 2006, it was a legitimate insurgency. They had Al-Qaeda leadership come in from overseas. They had financing organized. And now we were dealing with an organized enemy that had a serious will to win.
So what is life like over there? Because you're married at this point, no communication because your wife's not going to call you. Do you ever call her?
I'd call her about once a week. And, this is to give you an indication of what it was like mentally. One time my wife sent me an email, because you do get email over there. And she said, hey, the kids want to see a picture of where you sleep. Okay, fair enough. The kids are probably thinking it's bedtime. I wonder where daddy's sleeping right now. So I said, okay, I'll send you a picture. So at this point, we were living in an old Saddam regime building. It was a pretty nice big picture, almost like a mansion, but it was all sandbag windows. And, we had rewired the whole thing and there's plywood separating different rooms and stuff. But I went in there to take a picture of where I slept, which was just, a basic cot.
Yeah.
And as I looked at it, I took a couple pictures and I looked at the pictures and I realized that, look, I didn't have any pictures of my family up there. So I took a folder that I had. I opened it up. I took the pictures of my family out. I hung them up on the wall around my bed. I took a couple pictures for my wife. And then I pulled those pictures back out. I put them back in the folder. I put them back in the drawer because I didn't want to be looking at my wife and kids every day while I'm over there. And even though your wife and kids are important, when you're in combat and you're leading guys in combat, you're responsible for their lives. I don't want to be thinking about anything else, but how can I make sure that these guys have what they need to do their mission and stay alive?
Man, I didn't, I don't think I really had a total grasp of how important team is to you guys over there or in general. When you're talking about Navy SEALs, when a guy's watching your six, you're back. This guy has your hand is in his life. His life is in your hands. The trust factor. Ryan Jobe, was it?
Mark Lee.
Mark Lee.
Mikey Mansour.
Mark Mansour. Man, you guys are closer than close. What's the story with that? I mean, I don't think I have any friends that I'm that close with. I mean, these end up being your brothers. You wrote this book with Leif. Are you guys the closest of friends,
Absolutely.
Even though you serve together?
Absolutely. That brotherhood, and I kind of, that word is overused these days. It is overused these
right.
days. But the fact of the matter is, that's what it is. And it is actually, Mark Lee's mom would tell us that Mark would say, well, Mom, these guys are like my brothers. And Mark had brothers. So he'd say, these guys are like my brothers. And she said, before he was killed, she'd say, I know what you mean, but they're not really your brothers. And then when Mark got killed and we all came home and she met us and she saw us and she got to know us and she realized, and she was telling me a couple weeks ago, she said to me, you know, I realized once I was with you guys that you really were Mark's brothers. And she said it was a bond. It's a bond that's so strong. It almost is stronger than the bond that he has with his real brother. Not taking anything away from that, of course. By the way, his brother's also a Marine, just an awesome guy. But there is a brotherhood that is very real. And when you go out on the battlefield with your brothers, it is a bond that is, in my mind, probably stronger than any other bond that human beings can have.
When you guys are over there, what's the schedule that you're on? Because it's 24/7. When you get a chance to sleep, and what the fuck are you guys eating? Is it MREs every day?
Some of the, as far as what you're eating, the logistics, it depends on where you are and what you got going on. Man, we would go to some Army outstations in the middle of nowhere on my first deployment, and these guys would be living on MREs. Then you'd go to some main big base, and these guys would be eating better than they eat in a five-star restaurant. And when we were in Ramadi, we had somewhere in between. On our little base, we had some not the best food in the world, but there was a bigger base that was close by that we could drive to for the big chow, and that was good food that was good to go. When you're out in the field, obviously you're not eating much. You know, you bring maybe a couple MREs and deal with that. And as far as your sleep goes, yeah, you don't get to sleep a lot. You don't get to sleep a lot in combat. You don't get to sleep a lot even in the environment where guys are going into combat, because there's just so much planning that has to be done and so much coordination. It's just, it's like working a bunch of Mondays in a row. I used to say deployment is like 180 Mondays in a row for us, because it's a Monday, Monday, Monday. Just the work doesn't stop.
When you get sent over a tour, is there a length of time that you go for and then you go back? Or is it just, hey man, you might be there until they just give you the call back?
Well, for us in the SEAL teams at that time, we were doing basically 6, maybe 7 month rotations. But you know,
if you're down for 6 months, how long are you back?
It depends. Usually, they try and get you home for a year or so in between. But let's remember these Army cats. Some of these Army guys that we were with in Ramadi, they deployed for 14 months, 16 months at a time. So some of those guys, when we got to Ramadi, had been there for 14 months fighting.
Man, there's graphic descriptions of some of the action that go on in the book, and I, the best thing for me was listening to the audio book, because it's yourself and Leif, you know, breaking down one of the pieces of action or combat that you guys were in, and then making a principle out of that, and then breaking that into a business setting of how you guys are going around helping these corporations, you know, these people learn how to be leaders. But before we get back to the book, dude, when you're immersed as heavy as you are in that hot of a zone in Ramadi, and you come back, right back out of the shit, and then you go to home life, how bad of a head fuck is that? Because, man, I mean, this is what you want. You love your family, but, I mean, you're spun up. You're redlining at 9,000 RPM. Boom, you're back at the crib. How hard is that?
Well, I think when we look at our veterans right now, I think you can see that there's a variety of ways that people handle that. Some of them good, some of them not good. And we got a lot of veterans that come back. They compartmentalize, and this is what I try and do, compartmentalize what happens overseas. You keep it in a box. You know that it's there, but you know, you try not to live in that box, right? And unfortunately, it's hard for people to do that. It could be hard for me to do it at times. I was actually on a bicycle last night, just randomly coming home from a little restaurant, and I was by myself, and I turned a corner, and it was dark in an alley, and I just had a little split second thought that it looked exactly like I was overseas. And so you can't make that go away. And you know what, Steve? I don't want it to go away. I like what I did. I like having the feeling of, I guess you might call it paranoia, but I like that. That is an edge. It's a place I like to live. But I think what happens with some of our vets is that starts to take over, and they either drink it, try and drink it under submission. Maybe they start using drugs. There's a lot of the prescription drugs and prescription pain meds. So guys, unfortunately, start going down that spiral. And you know what we got to do as a nation is do our best to try and help them come back to the light and away from that darkness.
So you dealt with it in a pretty good fashion. With your enthusiasm for MMA, would you spend a lot of time in the gym sparring and honing your MMA skills, or at least taking some angst out against another guy in an octagon?
Yeah, there's no doubt that jiu-jitsu for me and MMA in general, it is a drug for me, right? When I come in here to my gym and I get to train jiu-jitsu or train MMA with somebody, man, I feel great. I feel great when I get done. Whether I win or lose, it doesn't matter. It's an escape from... I shouldn't even say it's an escape. It just clears your mind. It just clears your mind of all the chaos that's in there. And yeah, definitely it's a good way to get out aggression because you're fighting against another human being. So for me, MMA and jiu-jitsu was a huge help for me to continue. It's something I did it before I went to war, and I keep doing it now, and I'll always be doing it.
Okay, but what if I said, Jocko, MMA, you're done. You can't do it anymore. If I could just impose that on you, what then would you do?
Well, we would have an actual MMA fight at that time.
Any other coping mechanism? I mean, like, what about your, could you just start banging weights and just go gym junkie?
Yeah, I think, oh, you're looking for other things that people do.
Yeah, no, just if I said, hey, I'm taking MMA away from you, Jocko, you got to do something else.
Yep.
I mean,
Well, actually,
you're a very physical person. You've got to do something.
Yep, you're right. And you know what's a good way to take MMA away from me is MMA is jiu-jitsu is one of those things in the world that you need another person to train with you. So when I'm on the road and there's nobody else to train with, you're exactly right. I do whatever I can do physical. If there's a gym, I'll hit the gym. If there's no gym, I'll sit in my room and do burpees and sit-ups and push-ups until I puke. Because you're right, I got to do something physical because that physical activity gives me a sense of relief and stress release and all that stuff.
Like, what do you currently do just to stay in shape? I know you spend a lot of time training people here, or sometimes, but you still spar with the cats that I met, pro fighters down there. Just your physical fitness routine now, is it burpee squats? You doing free weights? What the fuck do you do just to maintain Jocko?
I do everything. So I definitely lift weights. I mean, I do deadlift, squats, overhead squats, clean and jerks, snatches. I have kettlebells. I got a pretty nice, maybe I'll take you there later. I got a pretty nice little home gym I got going on. And so I do all that, but I also do calisthenics. You know, I also do pull-ups. I do push-ups. I do dips. I do sit-ups. On top of that, I do sprints. You know, I sprint. I have a rowing machine. I have a stationary bike that I'll sprint on. I'll sprint around, you know, running sprints. I'll go to the beach and sprint. Just all of the above.
You ever then, because as a Navy SEAL, there can never be a state of overtraining because everything you do is building for the ability to sustain an attack, carrying somebody, carrying your gear, this, that, or whatever. It's always physical. Now that you're 44, you're still training like a bastard, but is there ever an overtraining state, or do you back off? Do you cycle things? Because as a SEAL, dude, you didn't have to be great. Like you said, you have to be a great athlete, but mentally, like a motherfucker, and then physically strong enough to get the task done. I'm asking, do you ever worry about overtraining? Does overtraining exist in Jocko's world?
It does exist. Now, I'll tell you that people ask me all the time, well, hey, do you ever schedule days off? And I tell them, no. And I'll tell you the reason why I don't schedule days off is because life will schedule your days off. How many days off you got right now? Because you got that bad, you know, you got shoulder surgery. So you got to take some time off. There's nothing you can do about it. Sometimes I got to travel. I'm on a plane. I got to get on the plane at 4 o'clock in the morning. I got to get up at 3. No, I'm not going to sleep for 1 hour and work out. No, I'm going to take a day off that day. Maybe the water heater explodes. Maybe the car breaks down. Maybe the kids are sick. Life will give you days off. That's what I've found. And so when I got the opportunity to get it on, I'm going to get it on.
Right. The Resurrection of Jake the Snake documentary is finally out on DVD and Blu-ray. And man, I can't say it enough times. You have to see this documentary. This is one of the most inspirational stories I've seen. And believe me, you ain't got to be a wrestling fan to watch this documentary because It's not a wrestling story. It's a story about how Diamond Dallas Page literally saved Jake's life. Dallas and director Steve Yeun spent 3 years working with Jake to help him get his family, his health, and his career back. Now, Jake was in a bad place, headed towards certain death, and it's remarkable to see the transformation he undergoes through the movie. And everyone who's seen this documentary says the same thing. They laugh. They cried, and they left feeling inspired. And even if you've already seen it, you're definitely going to want to pick up a copy of the Collector's Edition DVD. Dallas went all out for the DVD release. It has 20 bonus features, including commentary by Dallas, Jake Roberts, and director Steve Yeun. And right now, you can get the Collector's Edition of The Resurrection of Jake the Snake at ddpyoga.com/Austin and get 10% off anything you buy for a limited time. So get the documentary and then get yourself on the DDP Yoga program and do all that for 10% off by going to ddpyoga.com/Austin. As Dallas always says, all you have to do is commit. And when you see what that commitment did for Jake the Snake, you'll want to commit too. Start living a healthier life today. Go to ddpyoga.com/Austin for a limited time. Get 10% off anything you buy. All right, before we get back to the book, I want to talk about the book. But before, when was your last tour in Iraq?
My last tour, I got home. I left Ramadi, Iraq, October 21st, 2006.
Okay.
Well, so it's been almost 10 years.
What changed from your first tour of Iraq through your last tour of Iraq, seeing some of your best friends go down and pay the ultimate price, and just all the things that you saw and went through? How did Jocko change as a human being through those years and stepping away and looking back?
Well, I can tell you that combat is a very humbling thing that will humble anybody. And anybody that's been to real combat, sustained combat, they're not going to come back thinking that they're Billy Badass and no one could ever take them. They're going to look around at the world and say, you know what? There's things in the world that will get the better of me if I'm not careful. And so my first deployment to Iraq, like I said, was relatively easy, and I felt pretty good about it, and I felt like we did a good job. I mean, we got a few firefights. I think I had one guy get wounded. Wasn't really bad. So you feel kind of like, you know, we're, and I hate to use this word, but we might be invincible. And, you know, my second deployment, where we were in real sustained combat and my guys were out getting after it on a daily basis. And every time, you know, I was the commander, I wasn't going out on every operation, but when they were going out on an operation, I knew that there was a pretty good chance that one of them was going to get hurt, one of them was going to get killed. And there was nothing. There was one of those things. It was an impending feeling that I had and that everybody had. Everybody knew that. And all those badass guys, they rolled out the gate every time knowing that that could happen with to any of them. So, number one, I have just a massive amount of respect for the guys I worked with. And I'm not just talking about the SEALs. I'm talking about the Army soldiers and the Marines that were there with us, that those guys were doing the same thing we were doing, if not harder. They were living out in town. You know, we lived back on base a little bit. They stayed right out in the worst parts of Ramadi. So nothing but respect for the guys I worked with, both in the SEAL teams, my task unit, loved those guys. But the Army, the Marine Corps, you know, there was the brigade that was there, the 1-1 AD, the Ready First Brigade, just filled with a bunch of amazing, brave American soldiers, and the Marines that were there with us as well from 3-8 Marines. I can't even say enough words to tell you what those guys mean to me and the amount of respect I have for all of them. So I'd say that's the biggest takeaway I had from my first deployment to my second deployment.
And when you went over there and you got the 4-1-1, that you guys are going to have to start training some of the Iraqi troops. And like, man, that met with a lot of dissent from a lot of the guys. Like, are you kidding me? I mean, we're the elite. We're the best of the best. And now we've got to train these guys. And then you had to convince them of, you know, why you need to train them. And you guys could go out on a mission because you're being held back from going on a mission. But if you took those people... Right. Explain to me, sitting 3 feet from me, and I listened to the audiobook, and again, I highly recommend this book, whether you listen to it or read it, it's a badass book. Frustrated as fuck.
Yeah, It's so picture this.
Yeah.
So here we are. We're in the SEAL teams. We work with all these guys. We grow up with them. We go through all the same training together. We know that they're all physically fit, pretty damn motivated. And that's who we're going to go to war with. And if you're going to go to war, like I just talked about the brotherhood, if you're going to go to war, especially if you're going to go to war like a place like Ramadi, you're going to want to go with your brothers that are going to have your back, that you know would literally die for you, which my guys prove they would die for each other and for our team and for our brotherhood. So that's a proven fact. And that's what we know going into combat. Well, when we got to Ramadi, we got told that we weren't just going to be working with SEALs, that we were going to have to do our missions with Iraqi soldiers. Now, when I use the term soldiers to describe the Iraqis, it barely fits, because there's no American soldier. I mean, an American soldier compared to an Iraqi soldier, you can't even, it's like the different breed of animal, right? An American soldier is an awesome, squared away, individual, motivated, all that stuff. Iraqi soldier is just the opposite.
Man, let me bust in.
Go ahead.
God dang, I was listening to the damn book, and on one occasion, y'all met with some force from the insurgents who appear to be salty as fuck. So the insurgents are shooting at you guys. You got the Iraqi troops. The guys with the Iraqi troops turn around, and they're firing their guns back behind them, so you had to yank their guns from them because they're about to shoot you guys.
Yeah.
A coward, just total coward bullshit. That...
I don't want it to come across that they were intentionally trying to shoot us in that scenario. What they were trying to do was shoot back at the insurgents, but because they had just no muzzle discipline, no safety, no understanding of how to use a weapon in a proper... And this is after we were working with them. Because you know what? Honestly, when people go into combat, they get scared. And one of the things that American service members know how to do is learn how to control that fear a little bit. Because, you know, if you think you're getting shot at, well, hey, I'll just point my rifle down there and start blazing away. You're not thinking about where friendly forces are. That's when you have seriously bad things happen. So that's a classic example of what we were dealing with as Iraqi soldiers, where there's enemy force located somewhere down the street, but in between the Iraqi soldiers and the enemy, there's SEALs. And they're maneuvering, fighting, engaging. Well, the Iraqi soldiers start shooting towards the enemy, but they're shooting towards the friendlies. They're shooting towards our SEALs. And so, yeah, we got to go grab them, lift their guns up, take their guns away from them. It was definitely a bad situation. And so when we knew that it was going to be like this. So when we got told, okay, you're going to be working with Iraqi soldiers, the instinct from me and from my guys was, you got to be kidding me. We don't want to do this. This is horrible. This is going to get guys killed. And so myself, from a leadership position, what I had to do was look at the situation and ask myself, okay, why are they making us do this? Why is the White House, the Pentagon, the generals, the admirals, the colonels, why are they telling us we got to work with these Iraqi soldiers? This is going to be way more risky. It's going to be a lot more dangerous. What are they trying? Why would they be making us do this? And I realized as I asked myself that question, that if we didn't work with those Iraqi soldiers and get them to a point where they could handle the security in their own country, then nobody was going to do it. And they were going to have to, we Americans would have to stay there in Iraq forever. So I realized that and then told my guys, listen, we got to get these guys trained up. If we don't do this, nobody's going to do it. So let's get in the game. Let's do our best with these Iraqi soldiers and see what we can make out of them.
And part of that is in the book, As a Lesson in Extreme Ownership, How U.S. Navy SEALs Lead and Win. Question for you. When the shit does go down and you have the enemy firing at you, and you said as a Navy SEAL, you have a way to calm yourself because, hey, yeah, you just don't stick your gun out. And you do. But what are you thinking? What do you do to calm yourself? Because, dude, I'm a hunter. Love to hunt and be out in the woods. I'm a redneck marksman. I'm nowhere near the caliber of that, but I love to shoot. I never had anybody shoot back at me. And so if you guys are all of a sudden laying down some fire and the insurgents are shooting back at you, what is the technique you use? How do you stay calm? Because, man, I'd probably shit myself because I don't have no technical training. Talk me through that.
Well, one of the things that they do a really good job of in the SEAL teams is getting you inoculated to that fear, meaning they put you in such stressful situations during training that you're not going to be 100% ready for it, but you're going to be close. And the first time I ever got into a firefight where I realized I was getting shot at. I was just kind of normal. I just kind of looked around, looked at my guys, see where they were, saw them reacting, said, hey, guys, let's get online. Guys got online. I said, shift right, which was just a very easy command call. The guys all did what I said. I was mentally prepared for these situations. When you're going through SEAL training, the SEAL training that we run, like I said, not the basic stuff that you see on TV, but the real advanced training, it prepares you for this kind of thing. We blow stuff up. You got machine gun fire going on. We use paintball and simulations to make things as realistic as possible. So that way, when it happens for the first time, you don't freak out. You're ready for it. And you're ready to do your job like a man.
When you decided to, or what made you decide to write the book incorporating everything you learned as a Navy SEAL and to apply this to businesses and corporations all over the world? How long did it take you to come up with the idea? Was it you? Was it Leif? Or was it you together say, hey, we learned a bunch of badass stuff being Navy SEALs about leadership. That's what we do. Let's write a book and help corporations. Who came up with that?
Well, we were actually when right before I retired, I had a buddy that was a CEO of a big company, and he said, hey, can you come talk to my executives about combat leadership? And I said, yeah, sure, I'll do that. Went up, talked to his executives. When I got done, he came up to me, shook my hand, and said, hey, I want you to do this for every division at my company. And I said, okay, I'll do that. Thought I was going to retire. So I ended up, you know, I retired from the SEAL teams, but now all of a sudden I was doing these talks. One of those divisional talks that I gave, the parent company that owned my buddy's company was there. And he said, I want you to come talk to all my CEOs. He had 45 or 50 companies that his organization owned. I went to do that, spoke in front of a bunch of CEOs. I got done with that. A bunch of those CEOs came up to me and said, I want you to come and talk to my company. I want you to come talk to my company. So the next thing you know, my hands were full. That was about the same time Leif was getting out of the Navy. He had actually had formed a relationship with a company he was helping out. And so we got together and said, hey, we got a lot of businesses in America that need this help because people really don't understand leadership the way we do. So we started working with a bunch of different companies. And every one of these companies that we'd work with, when we'd get done, they'd come up and say, hey, do you have these lessons written down somewhere? Do you got these principles written down? Can you write these down so we can give them to the guys that couldn't make the meeting? And eventually we said, all right, well, let's write them down. And once we wrote them down, they ended up in the hands of a literary agent, which is a person that sells books to book companies. And that person brought it to a book company, booking them, said, yeah, we want to publish this. And the next thing you know, we were publishing the book.
How long did it take to write this book? I mean, like you said, you had all the blueprints, you had all the talks. How long did it take to put the book together, you know, from inception? Because here's the thing. Here's the real cool thing about this book. And jump in, Jocko, because you go from a real-life war setting, and then you go principal. And then you break down what you learned out of whether it was, you know, searching houses, you know, I think discipline, maybe the last chapter, going through search houses, you had to make a new system. And there was a lesson to be named out of it. And then you go into a principle. You talk about what you just learned through being in battle and then as applied to business. And that's one of the things that was so fun about the book, to see how all this stuff, all the techniques that you learned applied to business. That wasn't in the original manifesto because you weren't thinking along the business lines yet.
Yeah, especially because the first time I ever wrote down these principles, I did it for the SEAL teams. I did it to say, hey, guys, this is what you need to stay alive in combat. This is what you need to do to win in combat. And so when we started doing it for businesses, it was, okay, I guess these really do apply to business world. And it didn't take me very long to realize that when you're in a leadership position, what you're trying to do is get a group of people to accomplish some mission in the most effective and the most efficient manner. Now, if that mission in the SEAL teams is to go out and capture, kill bad guys, okay, you're going to use those leadership principles. If the mission in the business world is to take a group of people and have them build something or create something or sell something, guess what? The leadership principles are the same, regardless of which group of people you're leading and regardless of what the outcome of the mission is. The leadership principles don't change.
Two ways to describe a leader.
Effective and ineffective.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's one of the things that we talk about in the book, because people say, oh, is this guy a good leader or a bad leader? And the question is, are they accomplishing their mission? If they're accomplishing their mission, they're effective. If they're not accomplishing the mission, they're ineffective. Easy as that.
I enjoyed every bit of this book from start to finish. This ain't no bullshit plug. It's just straight up truth. But chapter 12, when you bring it home, discipline equals freedom. The dichotomy of leadership. I love that chapter. You got this thing with your alarm clock, with your watch, with you getting up every day, and on your Twitter account. What's your Twitter account? At Jocko?
At Jocko Willink.
At Jocko Willink. Many times, or most every morning, you take a picture of your watch, it's 4:30, 4:45.
Every morning.
Every morning.
That's the discipline.
At Jocko Willink. So talk to me about that, because you covered in the last chapter, discipline, and how paramount that is and the way you live your life, and a big part of this book.
Yeah, well, as an individual, right, we all want to have freedom. I mean, everybody wants to have freedom. Everybody, every American that's listening to this right now wants to have freedom in their life. They want to have every kind of freedom possible. I mean, the two that I talk about all the time are, we want to have financial freedom, right? We want to have enough money to do what we want. And we want to have more free time. Those are like two major things that everybody wants to have, two types of freedoms that everybody wants to have. But let me ask you this question. How do you get financial freedom? You got to have financial discipline. You got to save your money. You got to work hard. You got to put your money in the right places. You can't be blowing your money on stuff that you don't need to blow your money on. That's what it is. Now, on the other side, there's time. We want more free time. Well, let me ask you this. How do you get more free time? You get more free time by having more disciplined time management schedule. If you're lazy, you get out of bed late, you don't have an organized plan of what you're going to do that day, by the end of the day, you haven't gotten the stuff done you're supposed to get done. Now you don't have any free time. Whereas if you actually have a plan and you have a system and you attack that plan early in the day, guess what? 3, 4, 5 o'clock comes around, maybe 6, 7 o'clock. You got some time to relax, spend some time with your family, do what you want to do. So those are two real clear examples of how discipline actually gives you freedom. And so that's the way I try and live my life. The same thing with staying healthy, right? Everyone wants to be free from being sick. Everyone wants to be free from injuries. Everyone wants to be, you know, able to move around real easily. Well, guess what? If you want to be that way, you got to have discipline. You got to work out. You got to eat the right foods. You got to sleep enough, all those things. You got to have those kind of disciplines in your life. Otherwise, you're going to be a slave to being sick and a slave to being injured. That's just the reality of it.
Dude, here's the thing about the book. You wrote this book teaching people how to be leaders. But if you're, I don't want to say a slacker, but if you're just someone who's cruising along in life and you're happy-go-lucky and you're status quo and everything's cool, that's all fine and dandy. But just because you might not perceive yourself to be in a leadership position, maybe I shouldn't read that. I'll never be a leader. No, you should absolutely read the book, because there's chains of leadership. There's chain of command. So you might not be at the top, but there's a place where you fit in there in the middle. And I would tell this to all the guys in the dressing room at WWE to read this book, because as part of being a leader or ascending to the top of a leader is communication. So if you're a leader at the top, and if you're scared to talk to that leader and voice your concerns, your ideas, your reasons why you disagree with what the leader's doing, and you don't establish any type of relationship or communication with them, well, then you're failing to help that leader and failing to help your position. So I was motivated by the book. I'm not really part of a team, so to speak, right now, but just if you're just a solo person, that last fucking chapter 12, and I love the whole book, but that was enough to light a fire under my ass just as far as motivation for me. So again, chain of command, dude. Just because you're not at the top doesn't mean that you don't need leadership skills or have any wherewithal about what the fuck's going on.
Yeah, when we talk about leadership, we're definitely not just talking about the people at the top of the chain of command. We're talking about everybody in the chain of command. In my task unit, there was leadership at every single level, right down to the frontline SEAL that wasn't in charge of any person, but he was in charge of his piece of the mission and took ownership of it and led it. And that's what made the whole team good, was that every level of leadership had that intensity, had that ownership of what they were doing. They took responsibility and they led. Again, like you said, not that they were in charge of anybody else. They led their piece of the mission, just like you're leading your life. You know, you might not be in charge of anybody right now. We know you're damn sure not in charge of your wife, apparently. But you know what? But you know what? You take leadership and you take ownership of what you're doing in your life, and that's how you're so successful right now.
There's a great story in the book, but I'm not going to give it to you, but it's a great story. It's about leadership. And the guys were going through, I guess it was Buds, but it was the boats. And there was boat 6 and there's boat 2. And one leader was great, the other not so much. And then there's the old switcheroo-ski of the captains, and you got to read what happens next. I love that story.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, that is a classic case of what a great leader, a person who takes ownership of leadership, can do with any given team. You can have a great team, but you have to have a damn good leader. Like you say in the book, there's no bad teams, only bad leaders.
Only bad leaders. And we would see that all the time when I was running the SEAL training and putting platoon after platoon after platoon through these very hard training cycles. If they had a good leader, it was going to be a good platoon. If they had a bad leader, it was going to be a bad platoon. And if we fired the bad leader and brought in a good leader, all of a sudden you had a good platoon. It's as simple as that.
Man, it was another good story. I think it was chapter 11. It was a guy with the electrical company, and the one guy he was kind of taken care of. And so he had to make the ultimate call.
Right.
And that's just part of, hey, are you looking out for the good of the team? Or are you looking out for your buddy? Because if you're team-oriented with this, which the companies that you work with, that's basically a team, because it's for the greater good of the company, not about preserving one cat and helping people make these decisions. The thing about the book was there's so much common sense, but you just bring it all home in 12 chapters. It's like the old Back to the Future movie, Hello, McFly. But you know, sometimes you're so far in the forest, you don't see the trees.
That's true.
And so the book is very straightforward. It wasn't written by two rocket scientists. It was written by two guys who have been there, done that in a Navy SEAL and applied this. And y'all formed Echelon Front, the name of your company. So now with writing this book, it was a New York Times bestseller, still on the high on the list.
It is.
How busy you guys? Where the fuck are you going? All over the United States, all over the world? Sorry about the language. I get excited when I talk to about stuff like this.
Yeah, we are, man. We're all over the world, and we're working with companies all over the world. We're working with people all over the world. And like you said, the lessons that you took out of the book, there's people all over the world that feel the same way and think the same thing, and so they want more. And you know, some, if it's a company, they want more, they contact us, we go out, we work with the company. I actually started my own podcast.
Oh,
right?
We got to talk about the Jocko podcast.
Yeah, and I, this is another place where people have gone from the book, now they're listening to the podcast, so they can hear more about the experiences that I've had and about war, really.
So talk about the Jocko podcast for a little bit, because it's dropping once a week. Here's the thing, man. We're at Victory MMA, and I was going to meet Jocko at the recording studio. I guess that's where you record the Jocko podcast?
Yep.
But, you know, I was talking to your assistant. I said, man, it'd be cool to go down to Victory MMA just to get a feel for the place, and it did. I got excited since I came in.
That's why we're sitting in the closet right now trying to record this thing.
That's a whole nother story for a whole nother podcast. I'm in a room with a bad wing with one of the baddest cats walking planet Earth, and we're talking MMA and leadership skills. Your podcast, you're breaking down the situations you've been in. You ever consider writing another book?
Yeah, we're definitely going to write another book. We're definitely going to write another book, and we're going to talk about, you know, some of the other leadership principles that we used, some of the other leadership principles that we now see applied from the battlefield to the business world. There's leadership is a, it's one of those paradoxes that leadership is very simple, but it's also very complex. And sometimes with people, you got to tell people's stories a different way, and they see it a different light, and now they understand it, whereas they didn't understand it before. So this is a situation where we got to unwind some of those complexities of leadership and make them simple so that people can understand them.
We're here at Victory MMA. Are you training today?
Yeah, I'll be training today.
What are you doing?
I'll be doing some grappling, some hardcore grappling. What is it, Friday night? Yeah, Friday night. Yeah, I'll be getting some rounds in tonight.
So no, you're not out on town drinking beer?
Negative.
Do you drink?
Honestly, I don't really drink anymore. You know, the SEAL teams, I did plenty of drinking. The SEAL teams probably more than I should have. And when I got out and retired, yeah, I just haven't really been drinking since then.
Do you, man? Mark Lee, you guys had just taken over a building. Obviously, tension was pretty high. And then going back to the old 1999 Navy SEAL movie, he quoted a line. say the line.
Yeah,
he's no longer with us, respect. But it was a great story, because you guys actually have fun out there amidst all the danger.
Yeah, no, everyone, you know, everyone hears about Mark Lee. And, you know, unfortunately, the movie American Sniper, which is about Chris Kyle, who is the lead sniper and point man from Charlie Platoons, was one of the platoons, and Task Unit Bruiser, who was Leif, was his platoon commander. And obviously, Chris was a great friend of ours and a brother. Well, they made a movie, and in the movie, they portrayed Mark Lee very unlike Mark Lee, what Mark Lee was really like. In the movie American Sniper, they made Mark Lee out to be kind of this guy that was all quiet and cerebral and concerned about the war and all that and very serious. Mark Lee in real life was a riot. He was a hysterical guy. He, first of all, he completely believed in what he was doing. He knew that we were doing the right thing. He was totally on board with the mission. But on top of all that, he was hilarious, and he was always making everybody laugh. He was making fun of everybody all the time. And the one operation you're talking about, we went to rescue a hostage that was being held by some terrorists. And, you know, to be honest with you, at this point, with these type of savages that we're fighting, you don't expect to find a hostage alive. You expect to find them dead. So I was actually outside the building, and Leif and the team, his platoon, was inside the building. They had cleared it, and believe it or not, we were able to get the rescue the hostage, and he was alive. So they got a hold of the hostage. They confirmed who it was, and Mark Lee ran over to him and got in his face. And I forget the exact line, but it was something along the lines of, and it's a quote from the Navy SEALs movie that had Charlie Sheen in it, in the early 90s.
Michael Biehn quoted the line.
Yeah, and he says, you know, something like, "Hey, this never happened. We're Navy SEALs. Don't report this. We're here to get you out. You're going to be okay. This never happened." And it was one of those moments in time that no one will ever forget.
You guys had a good chuckle. But when all the shit's going down, when you guys are back at camp or whatever, I mean, are you always tense? Are you just waiting for the next thing? Or can you let your hair down, so to speak, and just enjoy being back at camp with your brothers? Or is it all like, goddamn, man, we're in fucking war?
No, actually, it's actually the opposite of what you just said. It's most of the time you're having fun.
Okay.
Most of the time you're having fun. Just like any job, you want to have a good time while you're doing it. And of course, I mean, there's times where it gets serious real quick, real hard, real fast. But then, you know, as soon as that lifts and you get a chance to have some fun, the boys are going to have fun. And Mark Lee's a class. Even Chris Kyle was a funny bastard. I mean, he was always cracking jokes and always giving people hard times. And that's what a SEAL platoon is. You know, it's a bunch of guys that are always having a good time with whatever they're doing, no matter how miserable it might be.
Man, I just going back to a few of the chapters, because there's the one chapter when Chris Kyle is up in a top of a building, top floor, and he sees a silhouette, and he's trying to determine whether he wants to take the shot or not. And he thinks something's up. Sure enough, was it you or Leif that go up there?
It was Leif. It was Leif.
Okay, and they're trying to say, okay, do we make the call or not make the call? And this was all such one of the hassles or the hardest things about urban warfare was determining, you know, location of where your friends were, because it'd be fracture side or blue on blue. All of a sudden, you've got a guy, or you're engaging on, it's friendly fire, but you're engaging your guys. And so, tense moment there. Well, I won't give it away here, but dude, how stressful was that? You know, that first early on in the book, there's a blue on blue altercation. I mean, how fucked up is that?
It's a nightmare. And for those of you that don't know what a blue-on-blue is, that's when friendly forces are shooting at friendly forces. I mean, a classic example that people would know about these days is Pat Tillman, the football player, was killed in Afghanistan. He wasn't killed by Taliban. He wasn't killed by Al-Qaeda. He was killed by friendly forces in a confusing situation where bad things are happening all around, and there was a firefight broke out, and for whatever reason, Americans started shooting at Americans, and it's a nightmare. And you take that into an urban environment, and an urban environment is infinitely more complex. Things are at closer ranges. You've got three dimensions now, because you got people in different stories of buildings. You got people in basements. You got people on rooftops. You've got people all over, in windows, in doors. You don't know where people are. And then you've got multiple friendly units out there on the battlefield at the same time, and it is very, very challenging to deconflict them all, especially when everyone mixed in with all these friendly units is a bunch of bad guys that are trying to kill you. So, yeah, we talk about that in the book extensively. It's one of the most difficult things to get control of in combat and to deal with in combat, and that is, where are your friendly forces? Where are the enemy forces? How do we make sure we're not engaging the wrong people?
But and one of the lessons learned out of it, it's one of the chapters of the book, and I'm not going to give the end of the story, but it was about owning up to whose responsibility was that. It's a great story in the book. Who's responsible for this? And I'll leave it at that because I don't want to give it away, but it was an extremely valuable lesson for everybody, but a premier part of this book.
Yeah, and you know, that's why I'll give it away. That's why we started the book off with that chapter. Because, you know, we had this situation happen where a group of my SEALs accidentally killed an Iraqi soldier. And, you know, I didn't have much good to say about the Iraqi soldiers, but you know what? They were on our side, and there was a confusing situation that happened out there. There was multiple gunfights going on at the same time. I had four different elements out there that were all engaged with the enemy. We had the enemy attacking from multiple different directions. And in all this, one of my sniper elements engaged a small element of Iraqis. And what did the Iraqis do? They attacked even harder. And so they actually called in the quick reaction force of Humvees to drive down to where they had been shot from and start. And these Humvees came down and started engaging with 50 caliber machine guns. That was my guys inside that building getting shot with 50 caliber machine guns. So this whole scenario happens. We eventually get it sorted out. And by the time we get back to base, you know, we're getting shut down from operations, and the investigating officer and the commanding officer are coming out to find out what the hell happened and who we going to blame for it. And these guys came out. We prepared the debrief, and the crux of the story is, I'm sitting there thinking, who the hell do I blame for this? Do I blame this guy who took the shot? Do I blame this guy who didn't give the report of where they were supposed to be? Do I blame this guy who didn't keep the Iraqis from going into a sector they weren't supposed to go into? And as I had all these different people to blame, as I'm sitting there thinking about it, I realized that there was only one person to blame. So I got the platoons together, brought the commanding officer in, the investigating officer, and I said, hey guys, you know who we got to blame for this? There's only one person to blame, and that's me. I'm the senior guy out on the battlefield. I'm responsible for everything that happens out there, and I will tell you what we are going to do to make sure this never happens again. And that's really, you know, the title of the book is Extreme Ownership. I had to take ownership of what went wrong, and that way I could fix it. Now, if I didn't want to own it, who's going to fix it? Nobody. So that's the way that story turned out. It was a bad situation, but we tried to take good lessons away from it.
And the bottom line, you owned it, but when you first asked that question, one of the guys raised his hand and said, hey, man, I should have radioed this. Another guy raised his hand, and you said, no. Who's responsible for this? And then you took the blame. But your brothers were willing to take that blame.
Yep. And that shows you that attitude of ownership, it spreads throughout the whole chain. And everybody in my task unit was willing to own up for these mistakes that had happened. No one was pointing the finger. No one was pointing at each other and said, you should have told me this or you should have done that. Everybody was saying, hey, you know what? I'm responsible for this piece. I'm responsible for this happening. I'm going to get it fixed. And that's why we didn't have situations like this happen again, because everybody took ownership of the problems and solved them.
Again, I go back to that last chapter of discipline when you describe what a good leader is. And the qualities that they possess and the things that they can't do wrong. And again, that applies to, I think it was that last situation I was talking about. But dude, I just love chapter 12. We can talk forever, but we've covered the book. It's Extreme Ownership, How U.S. Navy SEALs Lead and Win. Jocko Willink and Leif Baben wrote this book. They got Echelon Front. They're going on all over the place. Jocko, you got a website?
Got a website. echelonfront.com. If you want to hear the podcast is Jocko Podcast. It's on iTunes, it's on Stitcher, it's everywhere, it's out there.
And on Twitter, he's at Jocko Willink. Real quickly before we end this podcast, it's going to come on ASAP, but we were talking about UFC 199. We were making a couple of predictions, and then in the Luke Rockhold fight with Michael Bisping, man, Rockhold, break that down for me. You're a guy who, we're in an MMA camp right now at the Victory MMA Training Center here in San Diego. What happened in that fight in your eyes?
Well, it was pretty obvious to me, and it actually became pretty obvious to Rockhold after he got knocked out. And that wasn't, this is something we talk about in the book too, is, you know, the most important quality for a leader to have is humility. And you could see Rockhold, and he admitted it. He wasn't humble. He didn't respect his opponent. He thought it was going to be an easy fight. He didn't think he had to protect himself at all times. He got caught. And Bisping, you know, Bisping's a great guy. I've trained with Bisping before. I was real happy to see him get that win. But Rockhold's a good guy too. But you got to stay humble. And the minute that you're not humble is the minute that you stop training as hard as you can possibly train. It's the minute you stop preparing as hard as you need to prepare. When you're not humble, you start cutting corners. And when you're not humble, you go in the cage and think you don't have to fight the fight of your life. That's where you get hung up and caught, and that's where you get defeated. And that's why in the SEAL teams, we would always try and make sure we are staying humble at all times. And we're not afraid of the enemy, but we respect him. So we're going to be ready for him.
Being a part owner here at Victory MMA and also getting down to Octagon and training with a few cats, but overseeing a lot of things, or as you walk by and you've got some great young talents here, do you permeate or transfer? I mean, your Navy SEAL beliefs or everything that you've learned to these guys from a combat mindset or humility, humble, never underestimate anybody. I mean, surely you must pass that on to these guys that come through here. Never disrespect another cat.
Absolutely. That's something that we learned on the battlefield. And remember I said combat will make you humble, and I tell these guys the same thing. You got to stay humble because humble makes you hungry. And you got to stay hungry if you're going to be in this MMA game for sure.
And life.
No doubt about it. Life as well.
All right, everybody, give me to go home, Q. It's time to wrap up his podcast and ride off in the sunset. But before I do, I want to say thanks to Jocko Willink down there at Victory MMA training facility in San Diego. It was a pleasure talking to you. It was nice to meet you. And thank you for everything that you and your brothers have done for this country. It was a great experience down there. The book that we were talking about is Extreme Ownership, How U.S. Navy SEALs Lead and Win. I highly recommend the book. It's badass, and it's fired up my dumb ass to go out there and train harder, hold myself more accountable. Hey, folks, I'm going to give you guys something to watch. At the end of the podcast, I'm going to play a little clip of Jocko speaking, but my video for you to watch is if you go to YouTube and type in how to deal with failure, - Jocko Willink. How to deal with failure, Jocko Willink. It's a 4-minute and 7-second video. You're going to hear a short clip of that before I let you go on the back end of the podcast. But this is just a badass video that puts everything into perspective for me. It will get you off your ass and make you not feel sorry for yourself. I highly recommend the Jocko podcast. He talks about all kinds of things. He's a very intense individual. It's a very motivational listening experience. Give it a try. Hey, folks, let's move on and close this show. Let's talk about some T-shirts from Broken Skull Ranch. They're available at BrokenSkullRanch.com. My Broken Skull IPA beer from El Segundo Brewing Company is available at Whole Foods, Total Wines here in California. There's a link at BrokenSkullRanch.com to click on if you want it shipped to your house. The Steve Austin Broken Skull Cold Steel Knife is available at BrokenSkullRanch.com. Anyway, folks, hey, man, I want to say thank you very much for supporting the sponsors of the Steve Austin Podcast, because they're the ones who let me do this for you free twice a week. So big thanks to DDPYoga.com. Go to DDPYoga.com/Austin to get 10% off anything you purchase for a limited time, including the new collector's edition of the Resurrection of Jake the Snake documentary. To SeatGeek, download the SeatGeek app, use my promo code Steve, and get a $20 rebate after you make your first purchase. To TrueCar, and of course to Amazon, who have been supporting this podcast since day one. Just use my Amazon links whenever you're doing any online shopping, and Amazon will kick back a few bucks to the podcast. It will not cost you anything extra. There's no hidden fees or charges, and you can buy whatever you're planning on buying and help out the podcast in the process. You can find my Amazon links by going to podcast1.com. clicking on the Killer Deals button in the top right corner of the page, and then hitting the Steve Austin Show button. I got Amazon links for USA, UK, and Canada. If you bookmark it and click on that, it'll make it a one-step process. You get what you need. You help support the show. No hidden fees or charges. Hey, folks, keep listening. The 60-second AP News headlines are coming up next. I'm going to leave you with a soundbite from Jocko Willink. Until then, My name is Steve Austin, and I will catch your ass down the road. Go, Jocko.
We can give you, people always asking me, I'm here in the backyard. Or
one of my direct subordinates, one of my guys that worked for me, he would call me up or pull me aside with some major problem, some issue that was going on. And he'd say, boss, we got this and that and the other thing. And I'd look at him and I'd say, good. And finally, one day he was telling me about some issue that he was having, some problem. And he said, I already know what you're going to say. I said, well, what am I going to say? He said, you're going to say good. He said, that's what you always say. When something is wrong and going bad, you always just look at me and say good. And I said, well, yeah. When things are going bad, there's going to be some good that's going to come from it. Didn't get the new high-speed gear we wanted? Good. Didn't get promoted? Good. More time to get better. Oh, mission got canceled? Good. We can focus on another one. Didn't get funded? Didn't get the job you wanted? Got injured? Sprained my ankle? Got tapped out? Good. Got beat? Good. You learned. Unexpected problems? Good. We have the opportunity to figure out a solution. That's it. When things are going bad, don't get all bummed out. Don't get startled. Don't get frustrated. If you can say the word good, guess what? It means you're still alive. It means you're still breathing. And if you're still breathing, well, now you still got some fight left in you. So get up, dust off, reload, recalibrate, re-engage, and go out on the attack.
Download new episodes of Steve Austin Unleashed every Thursday at podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.